Hello, it's Tom here. We'll be getting into Last Orders, your favourite Nanny State podcast, in just one moment. The eagle-eyed listeners might have noticed that the show is now every 2 weeks. We've listened. So now you'll be able to get a new episode of Last Orders every fortnight with brand new guests. Do support us in this new venture by making sure you rate the show, share it with friends. We really want to spread it to as many people as possible. Another thing I want to let you know about and remind you about is our very special Spite Supporters event, which is coming up on Monday, the 19th of December. Our very own Brendan O'Neill will be live and in conversation with Toby Young. It's between 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. on Zoom. It's completely free, but you've got to be a Spite supporter. So if you are a Spite supporter, go to the Supporters Hub now to claim your free tickets. Not only will you be able to watch the live recording online, but you'll also be able to submit your questions to Toby and Brendan. And if you're not a Spite supporter, why not sign up today? It's just £5 per month, and that will give you access to not just this particular event, but all kinds of other exclusive perks. Once again, that's Brendan O'Neill and Toby Young on Monday, the 19th of December. Don't miss it. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spite podcast. On this episode, we discuss the illiberal online safety bill, Scotland's latest plans to ban booze advertising, and we take a closer look at the scourge of grooming gangs. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spite, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the IA. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm all right. Never missed an episode. Never will, Tom.
That's very good to know. And we're delighted to be joined, returning to the show for the third time, I believe, Charlie Peters, documentary filmmaker at GB News. Charlie, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hello, good to be here.
So we're going to talk about a lot today, but to kick things off, let's talk about our old friend, the Online Safety Bill, which is back in Parliament. It's just completed its report stage, and the big news is that the legal but harmful measure has been removed. So normally good news for free speech, good news for online freedom, was a quite concerning kind of Orwellian measure that was going to be introduced by this piece of legislation. But there's also, of course, all kinds of other things wrong with it that we might get into. But before we do that, Charlie, good news? Is this, how do you feel about the online safety bill being coming back in at least somewhat more liberal form at this point?
Sure. A small positive development, but if we're looking at the hole in the barn door, and we've got to remember the barn door itself, and the barn door remains enormously negative, that it's been changed a little bit to make it more conducive to liberal conversations and freedom of tech online is positive, sure, but the overall piece is still a disaster, and that it still exists in that format is, I think, a grave example of ministerial cowardice, because they know, I think, that those things aren't going to work. The plans they want are going to have a massive effect on so many important areas that they're trying to engage in, economic growth. The tech industry is going to have a disaster looking at all these various requirements, but because the bill is sponsored by DCMS, a department that probably shouldn't exist, and is full of civil servants who are hugely anti-trust, hugely anti-tech, very hawkish, and also sponsored by MPs from all sides who, let's be honest, are not particularly well-informed about technology for the most part, and seem to mostly support this bill because they don't know how to turn on notification filters on Twitter. So someone's nasty to them, as they often are, for being dreadful, as they often are, and they see that and think, we need to wrap me in cotton wool and fix the internet, but they don't really understand what they're doing, and it's having a devastating effect on technology.
I mean, as you say, the response from the Labour Party, as well as the kind of charities and the NGOs, has been that this is dreadful. I think the quote from the Samaritans was that they've snatched defeat from the jaws of victory and so on. So this legal but harmful thing did seem to be quite important to them, even though it was so Orwellian. It was a bit like non-crime hate incidents, as far as you create this kind of, we're not just going to criminalise certain speech, we're just going to empower some sort of third party, essentially the tech companies put under pressure by the regulator to just look for things which might be a bit upsetting and then get rid of them. So you're right, it's positive that that's gone away, but the mood music hasn't changed. So I suppose on some of the specifics, it's worth pointing out that this bill would still compel companies to filter and search messages for illegal content, which could have a big impact on things like WhatsApp and end-to-end encryption. You can't really have end-to-end encryption if you have back doors, which is another point that our kind of not particularly tech-savvy politicians don't understand. But also age verification, which has become a big part of this particular bill, which a lot of people have pointed out, this is a very difficult thing to get right. I think the last time the government tried to do this under Theresa May, the porn pass, the porn laws, as it was talked about, they ended up
with a plan that you would buy it in a shop. Yeah. So confused were they as to how to make this work. And obviously the danger here is that you end up with a kind of everyone has to play the internet on slow speed by default until you can get, you know, yourself verified. You've given Facebook your driving license or whatever in order to say that you're allowed to abuse MPs on the internet or wherever it is you like to go up to. But Chris, what do you make of this bill at this point? Not much to celebrate, or at least is it good that the worst excesses of it have been peeled away?
Like, yeah, I think it's definitely an improvement. Let's be honest. I mean, the legal but harmful thing was really Orwellian. So it's great that that's gone. And if they're genuinely just going to be looking now for illegal content, then that is more reasonable. But as you say, there's a lot of problems with it. You know, I don't think the internet needs regulating at all. It's been around for 30 years without any real problems to it. I know that there's this this poor girl who killed herself is always...
Molly Russell, yeah.
Molly Russell is always, you know, pointed to, and she's been kind of used as a justification for doing this stuff. I mean, I haven't followed her case very carefully, but was what people were saying to her illegal or just harmful or what?
It was the content that she was engaging with. Her father, who's been a big campaigner for legal but harmful restriction, has said that he believes that the content she was looking at was technically legal but harmful insofar as being essentially kind of pro-self-harm, pro-suicide or something along right. those particular lines. So that is the kind of emotive case that is being used as the battering ram. Right. It's so difficult.
The case is now irrelevant, right? If that stuff was legal, then it's now irrelevant.
Mm.
So this is now supposedly probably looking for like terrorist conspiracies and things like that, I guess.
Ugh.
Back to the illegal stuff, which, you know, it's more difficult to justify if something is you know, genuinely illegal. The trouble is that, you know, a lot of speech is already illegal under the current law, a lot more than people think. And so anything that's considered grossly offensive is illegal. Now, maybe, you know, if you're in the middle of the street shouting something grossly offensive, then that's one thing. But, you know, WhatsApp messages, a bit of bounce is something else.
Gross, right? It was worth saying grossly offensive, that bit of the Communications Act, I think, is going to be superseded by the Online Safety Bill. So they're going to take it out and it's going to be replaced by this hateful conduct offence, but which sounds as bad, if not worse. So, you know,
that would definitely
one step forward, two steps
back. I didn't know that. No, that's way worse because, as we've seen in, well, for several years, I think, especially in Scotland, you know, you can define hateful conduct much however you want.
Grossly offensive in the eye of the receiver is, of course, extremely woolly. And you can define it any way you want. So say, I am grossly offended by this.
Yeah.
For the nerds listening on, that is section 127 of the Communications Act 2003.
There we go.
Which is dying. But what is replacing it is also in need of a death, which is this hateful conduct thing. And people don't realise, and they have very quickly forgotten, that just over a month ago, we have had police officers jailed for sharing WhatsApp jokes, right? For sharing jokes, admittedly, about things that are, you know, very dark. But it doesn't justify jail. So if anything, rather than the Online Safety Bill, we need a massive reaction in the other direction, which liberates the internet more than constrains it.
And the difficulty is, and you kind of gestured to it there, Chris, is that even compelling the social media firms to clamp down on illegal speech leads to this overreaction. And we saw that in Germany in particular, they passed this NetzDG law in 2017, which was essentially saying social media firms, you must take down, I think within a 24-hour period or something close to it, hate speech content that's illegal under German law. But of course, you get this massive overreaction. So satirists, people taking the mick out of far-right parties, all sorts of different people were swept up in it because it's just censor first and ask questions later. I suppose it just gets to that point about, even though we've had this Tory government for quite some time, their ability to take the freedom of speech issue seriously has just never really been there to begin with, I don't think.
No, they don't take very many issues seriously apart from quite trivial ones.
Mm.
Or
stopping houses being built. They're very serious about that.
Yeah, exactly. Or stopping people stocking the cheese in the supermarket to the end of aisle. They've got straight onto that.
No. I think we're at risk of being a little bit too cynical here and misunderstanding the cynicism of the MPs, though. While they are not taking this stuff seriously enough and are using these laws to clamp down on... you know, on supposedly dealing with offensive and hateful conduct, I think actually they're being a bit smarter than we're allowing them. I think they're using, very cynically, the suffering of parents who've endured horrible tragedies, and they're using a general kind of normie, protect our children kind of atmosphere in order to push for things that they want, such as a kind of anti-so-called fake news agenda, anti-encryption, anti-tech. They're leveraging very successfully the feelings and the distress of parents who've suffered in order to push for something which will have no effect on that suffering and will not reduce it in the future, but will just allow them to push their own hobby horses over the line. So while they are, you know, being a bit silly and not really understanding the problem, they're also being incredibly cynical, incredibly strategic. And, you know, unfortunately, I think they will succeed in that.
And do you genuinely think a lot of it is just down to them not, you know, not liking being called names on Twitter?
we are hugely underestimating the extent to which the average MP understands technology by the experiences of them checking the Twitter app on their phone. I think they don't know how to turn on notification filters. They don't understand how to avoid most of the kind of the sewer side of the Twitter experience. So they just endure it, see it, and think this must be everyone's experience. Everyone must have hate as a problem. Mm. And often it's not hate, it's just criticism. They're very thin-skinned people these days.
Mm. It's a big moral panic, at least every 6 months, it feels like, because someone called Mark Francois another name or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there were so many, but the internet is very, very creative. Chris, you mentioned some of the classical sort of nanny state issues that this government and previous Tory governments have brought up. Let's go north of the border to Scotland, everyone's favourite kind of laboratory for all the worst nanny state ideas, and a new consultation around alcohol advertising. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about this and what they've got potentially proposed?
Yeah, well, minimum pricing came in 2018, and it's been such a roaring success that they're having to introduce more heavy-handed legislation to stop people drinking, and they think that alcohol...
Have people not stopped drinking in Scotland yet?
Well, alcohol-related deaths are at a 10-year high, so I guess not. And in fact, the entire evaluation of minimum pricing has been, you know, hilarious, really, in that it's just lobbied the policy. And I genuinely don't see how they're going to get it through the sunset clause next year, because it has to be, they have to prove that it worked within 5 years. Otherwise, it automatically gets repealed in the sixth year. They'll find a way of doing it. They'll find some friendly academic to do some retrospective modeling or something. But the evidence is pretty solid that it hasn't really worked. Anyway, so the next thing is alcohol advertising. This is what they're, yeah, sock puppet pressure groups have been pushing for the whole time. And they launched this consultation, which went way beyond, I think, what most people were expecting, because it essentially proposes a total ban on alcohol advertising, including in areas that the Scottish government can't possibly legislate on. So they've got no control over TV or radio advertising. They've got no control over internet advertising, really. But they've thrown all that stuff in there to say implicitly, well, if we were independent, we'd be able to do this. Mm. Apparently, the Scots are going to vote SNP because they want to get rid of Guinness adverts on TV. I don't know. Some of them do. The SNP remains remarkably popular, so I guess they must like some of this stuff. But so everything's in there, and it's not just everything that's in there. I mean, it's also the fact that they don't really try and present any evidence any of this is going to work. They just keep saying things like, well, we think it is likely that this will have an effect, or this may have an effect, and all this kind of stuff. Sponsorship. They're going to get rid of, which would be a huge deal for not just, you know, sporting events, but also cultural events. Mm. Think of the Edinburgh Festival and so on. How many parts of the Edinburgh Festival are sponsored by alcohol companies? Whiskey industry is obviously like one of the main exporters, and the biggest exporter, in fact, in Scotland. So have they thought this through? Do they care? I don't know. But I mean, a total advertising ban, or even an extensive advertising ban, which is what they're going to have to settle for because they can't do it all, have a huge knock-on effect. It really make, you know, the booze industry a lot less competitive, make it very difficult to launch new brands and things like this. And it's not like the tobacco industry, which basically had four or five major players and the advertising ban essentially kept them as incumbents, but they kind of already were incumbents. The booze industry is really competitive. You've seen craft beer over the course of the last 10, 15 years make huge inroads. You know, wine's been going up very strongly, various different gins, So this is economically a bad idea, but they seem determined to do something because almost for the sake of it, and this is always a problem with devolved governments, is you give them a few levers to pull, but not that many. And so they just pull them all just to show that they can. And then they complain about the levers they can't pull and say, well, this is why we need independence.
Which is a weird thing for Scotland. It's like, we need independence so we can get rid of the booze industry and on another day, fossil fuels, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
We want independence so we can be less free, essentially. Yeah.
The two things we have going for us, we can't.
Yeah, we want to rejoin the EU.
Yeah. Dreadful.
Right. Freedom.
I live in one of the coldest countries in Northern Europe. Well, I want to remove heating and alcohol. You know? It doesn't strike me as enormously intelligent, I have to say. But, you know, the Scottish nanny state industry keeps failing upwards. They lose wars. They get given more soldiers. They just, they can't find another way of disgracing themselves. And yet we keep seeing new attempts. And I spent 4 very happy years living up there, and I am desperate to return. But the Scottish government does everything it possibly can to incentivize me refusing to even look north of the border as a future place to live. I mean, everything they attempt to do to make life good, happy, and just fun. They clamp down on viciously. If you like censorship, not being able to drink, and redefining your gender on a day's whim, then Edinburgh
can't even
is a city
your
for
own
you.
Children.
Though. Yeah, I mean, what's the what, unbelievable? You can't sing football songs. You can't beat your kids. What's the point? I mean, it's just,
there's no joy in
cold
life anymore,
winter night.
What are you supposed to do?
And Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but also it seemed like they landed on this idea that they've got to ban all alcohol advertising because they admitted it'd be very tricky to ban it in any particular circumstances where young people would see it or something like that. So this is kind of admission: we've got to do it across the board because we can't.
Yes, I think largely that. I mean, it's just extremism, isn't it, really? I mean, if you look at the evidence on alcohol advertising, it's pretty sketchy, and it's mostly produced by people who are basically part of the temperance movement. Mm-hmm. But there's remarkably little evidence that alcohol advertising actually has any... It has the kind of effects that they think. Obviously, it has effects on brand share and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. But it doesn't make people drink more. And... Even the people who are proposing this kind of stuff, the academics, I mean, they look to places like France, which has quite an extensive advertising ban. It's not total, but, you know, the Heineken Cup has to be called the H Cup. And, you know, you can only show you can basically just show what the product looks like and say where it came from. And you can't make, you know, you can't show anyone enjoying it, for example. Okay. So pretty heavy handed restrictions been in since the early 90s, at which temperance people around the world were saying, this is the way forward. This is a model to follow. The academics go, that didn't really have any effect. And in fact, young people are drinking more than they did before. But that's just because it's not a total ban. And they look at other places, even places like Finland, which have almost total advertising bans. They go, well, it didn't go far enough. You know. So their theory is that you have to ban everything, otherwise it doesn't make any difference. And the logic behind that is that if you ban, say, broadcast advertising, internet advertising, the industry will just put more money into newspaper advertising mm-hmm. or magazine or whatever it might be, right? Which obviously they will do that to some extent. But if you really think that TV advertising is that powerful, then surely banning TV advertising in itself should have some effect. But they can't find any effect. It doesn't work. And the reality is that hardly anywhere actually has a comprehensive total ban on alcohol advertising, so it's impossible to evaluate it. Mm. So this is all just a chinny reckon. It's all just a guess.
Yeah.
You know, well, you know, we've tried all these things, and you can hardly see an alcohol advert in Norway, whatever. But... It still hasn't gone far enough, mm-hmm. but that's just a hunch, right? Mm-hmm. So the evidence for this is really, really poor. And, you know, even the Scottish government theoretically believes in evidence-based policy. There is a process to go through. There are impact assessments, I think, and stuff like that. And there's always a way to rig them. But I think it's going to be quite an interesting fight, actually. This consultation doesn't finish till late March. And my sense of it is that a lot of people in Scotland are quite uncomfortable with it. And of course, you always get the anti-Nats side will use any kind of stupid authoritarian mm-hmm. measure to beat Sturgeon with. So I think they'll get more kickback than they might be expecting. However, having thrown everything in the kitchen sink at this, if they then come out of it with 20% of it, they've still got a big win. Right? Mm-hmm. They've essentially moved the Overton window, and mm-hmm. you know the booze industry and libertarians and people who are against the SNP, they'll be fighting against a lot of it. But I think you'll find probably the Scottish government will end up with, for example, a ban on sponsorship or a ban on booze at bus shelters or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And Charlie, you were speaking there about the kind of litany of authoritarian things the S&P are into.
Sure.
I mean, taking Chris's point that this is kind of a feature of devolved government anyway, they want to flex the few muscles that they have and so on. What is it about the S&P that makes them such authoritarian nannying, even occasionally with some of their skins, quite kind of totalitarian sort of instincts? Where does that sure. come from?
I think there's probably an argument in nature, in that the kind of person I think there might be a puritanical streak that just is found within Scots. There must be some sort of cluster within the genealogy around Glasgow and Edinburgh, which kind of permeates into thought and writing. And everyone who is unfortunate to move there has to endure this kind of ecosystem of misery. It is a remarkably insular country. You know, Scotland is a village. And I think bad ideas can survive there because there isn't so much kind of breadth in the conversation and analysis. I mean, Chris was just talking about the Overton window there. They push for 100% of bad things, settle for 20 because you fail to push back against all of it, right? This is a very successful political strategy, yeah. which keeps happening there because there is an insufficient breadth of rejection for that 100% of things.
People, it's a one-party state and has been for a very long time.
I think there's two other things at work. One is, I can't fully explain it, but you know, if you look at cold Protestant countries moving towards the Arctic Circle, they're really anti-booze, right? And I think Scotland does look to the Scandinavian countries as some sort of a kind of social democratic model, and they're big nanny states for whatever reason. The second thing is that they constantly go on about the smoking ban in the Scottish government because they brought it in over a year before the rest of the UK did. And they, I mean, although it wasn't the first country to introduce a smoking ban, that was Ireland, it was one of the first, right? And they feel they got a lot of kudos from that and they were ahead of the pack and all this kind of thing. And so they've been always itching for something like that again. Minimum pricing was hugely totemic in that respect. No other country had done it. The eyes of the world are on this little country of 5 million people. And they do get, you know, the kudos from the public health people. You know, Nicola Sturgeon is on some bloody board that Mike Bloomberg set up at the World Health Organization. And there's always a job to go to afterwards as well.
Sure. There is a plucky small club mentality, I think, in Scotland. You know, it is like you were saying, everyone's looking at us. Aren't we so exciting and progressive? Every baby born in Scotland will get a special baby pack with a cot in it and stuff like that. Do you remember that? Do you remember that policy? Oh, you're going to have a great time Googling later. Yeah, when I was at uni there, they introduced this policy where every baby born in Scotland, regardless of wealth and income, was given like a £200 baby pack. So like everyone has the same equal of nappies and some like baby formula. And the box itself could be turned into a cot. So you got a free cot. But everyone got it. Ginormous waste of money. The country's on its knees economically. And you're giving like middle class mums in Morningside cots. I have no idea what's going on.
Cot.
Yeah, right. And, like, and then they say, oh, thanks so much.
But environmentally friendly.
You know, I'd rather not. So yeah, there is this kind of, I don't know, kid at the back of the class. I want to show how great I am. Let me do this silly idea just to prove that I'm here. Kind of thing that goes on. Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing trying to be like the Scandinavians, but if you're kind of, your political class is made up of kind of thick set necklace troglodytes, then you're never really going to emulate the gloriousness of Sweden and Norway, in my view.
And also you can't really liberalise very much. That's the thing about devolved governments and also local governments.
It only goes in one direction.
You can ban lots of things locally. Not everything, as we've seen with TV advertising and so on, but you can ban quite a few things. There's not many things you can unban. Because it's national legislation.
And people forget
that. Not that they want to, obviously, but I'm just saying that if you did get a government that wanted to do that, it pretty much would be have their hands tied. And therefore, in order to show that they are different to the scum in Westminster, you basically got to ban things.
And it's easy to forget some of the things that they tried and then didn't get away with, or things that they legislated for and eventually overturned. You know, locking up football fans for chanting offensive chants. That was, what was that, 10 years? The scandal of 10 years.
Yeah,
And then the name person scheme, which was the most terrifying thing they ever came up with. Every child gets a state guardian.
They never went through with that, did they?
As far as I
remember. They bottled it.
Got pushed back quite firmly against, thankfully speaking. But the sort of things they could have get away with, who knows? Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. Whilst we're on a slightly gloomy subject, Charlie, let's talk about what you've been working on very closely in recent months. So since you've joined GB News, you've been looking into the scandal of grooming gangs up and down the country and making a documentary about it, I believe. So this is something that we talk about periodically, obviously, whenever the latest horrendous decades-long scandal comes to the surface. But as someone who's been looking at all of them kind of in their totality, going to all of these different communities and so on, you know, what have you found out so far as you've been going on? Give us a little bit of a sense of what you've...
The most distressing thing is how much of the stuff that I have found out has been just lying in plain sight for years, but is not part of the national conversation. I've been with GB News full-time since October, but I've been working on this in the background for about a year, researching, reading every major report from the towns and cities that I've been lucky enough to have reports and reviews, independent inquiries, which is just two, actually. That's Rotherham's had one and Telford's had one. So I've been to both of those cities, but I've also been to Rochdale, and a few other places in England just to meet survivors and to visit councils and police. As I was saying, some of the really awful details from these places is in public record. It's in news, it's in clippings, it's in reports, often very long reports, you know, hidden in the middle of them. But the journalistic class in general and the political class has completely failed to exploit this shocking news and turn it into the story it needs to be because, well, several reasons, I imagine. Firstly, the victims that I am meeting are not, in their view, considered worthy. They don't care about them in general. A lot of these girls are, they're white working class girls from former industrial mining towns or you know, just industrial Victorian towns in the north of England. But some of them, they would be seen as underclass, not even working class, you know, girls raised in care. Mm-hmm. I have one police officer in Rochdale. We had an account of him saying to a junior detective that these girls would never contribute anything to society. It's not worth considering them. They're better off being drowned at birth than being cared for. It's a verbatim quote. So that's one major reason why it's been completely ignored. And I think it's probably the second biggest after the very distressing issue of ethnicity and the disparity in ethnicity between the most common perpetrator and the most common victim, and the gulf between majority kind of Pakistani grooming gangs and majority white working class victims has been too much for many to bear. Andrew Norfolk, the Times journalist who uncovered this scandal a decade ago in the Times, he first came across the story in 2003, didn't expose it until 2012. I mean, I think he's a hero for doing so, but the reason why he hid away from it in 2003 is because he felt like it was a far-right fantasy. He felt like this couldn't possibly be true, and if it were, it wouldn't be good for people to know about it. I think there was a sense of liberal angst that he refers to when he talks about his experiences in 2003. Labour MP Anne Crier tried to make complaints, derided as a racist, shut up, never spoke again. Same thing happened to Sarah Champion in 2018. You remember the Rotherham MP? She spoke about derided as a racist. You know, to her credit, she's campaigned a lot, but since that horrible attack, she's been much more quiet. And the intention and the mission of the film is to campaign for a few policies that I want to talk about now because we're going to try and actually have them passed. But also just to try and generate this national conversation that has never really happened, that has always been done very carefully, very difficultly, and as always, I think, and to our national shame, prioritised so-called social cohesion and community cohesion over the truth. And I think the truth is now more important than harmony, and we need some reaction.
And if anything, it seems like it is storing up a lot of tension and disharmony for the future by not tackling this head on. Because as you say, it does seem like periodically, anyone who found out about this early have said the same thing, Anne Crier, or similar thing. The only people saying this to me, the only time I'd ever heard this before is from the far right, the sort of thing that the MP used to talk about. And so you did get into a situation when the only people talking about it are the people who obviously want to exploit it to anti-Muslim ends, etc.
Sure.
Then you're going to get a situation in which it's those people are going to go to learn about this, to even have any space to discuss it. It's not to say that people are naturally going to be propelled towards the far right, but it creates a really difficult situation. And it does feel like, it's interesting because we seem at a bit of a different place now, Charlie, as far as back in 2003, you know, Anne Crier shouted down, took a long time for these stories really to be brought to the media's attention in any particular detail. What's interesting now is that there is a story every year or every few months or whatever about another particular locality. And yet, there's not much political action. There's not a lot of focus on it.
Yep.
It's just kind of reported and then it kind of melts away in a way that other much more superficial scandals which preoccupy Westminster don't. So what accounts for that? Is it just the continuation of that sensitivity in a slightly modified form, basically?
I think that is essentially it. It's the sensitivity and it's also denial. It's the fear of the truth and that they don't really want to accept this is still happening. Because it is still happening. I mean, we've identified through our research and visits 47 other towns and cities where there are credible reports of similar kind of gangs taking place between 1997 and today. Some of them have popped up in the last year or so. MPs from Bradford are campaigning for an inquiry. There are loads of people in major towns and cities asking for the same kind of treatment that Rotherham enjoyed, that Telford received. And even with these towns, I mean, the Telford report came out this year and found that as a conservative estimate, at least 1,000 victims. This is a town of 140,000 people.
And a number that was originally completely rejected by the police. They said they're sensationalized. Yep. I think the Mirror first came up with it and they were like, this is nonsense. Now they've had to admit that that's potentially an underestimate.
It almost certainly will be an underestimate. And the figure we got from the J report into Rotherham in 2014 was a conservative estimate of 1,400. The National Crime Agency has now found 1,510. So they've added to that. They've also found way more perpetrators. They've made some more convictions. But people I've spoken to in the town, campaigners, numerous kind of charity leaders and youth project workers, both retired and still active, say actually it's probably the case that the more accurate figure is closer to 2,000 in terms of victims from the same period. Even in the town, the city that's had the most investigation, the most discussion, Rotherham is the headline of this story, I think. If even there, the number of victims reported is still hundreds away from what the local experts on the ground, unfettered by kind of bias, think is actually the case. If there's still a massive gap there, then God only knows what it's like in other towns and cities where they have not enjoyed the same level of investigation. Why has there been such a gap, and why is there so little attention from Westminster to these places? Fundamentally, because I think in a lot of the places where this is happening, and this is a theme we keep seeing, keep encountering in the places we're investigating, is that the police and council are almost always involved in some degree of cover-up and denial in every single place we look at. Rotherham and Rochdale are the most extraordinary for this. I mean, people involved in handing over victims to the police and abusers to the police in exchange for nobody being charged with anything. Someone who organised and facilitated a handover of a victim to the police was actually made a councillor, became the deputy head of Rotherham's council. I mean, nobody knows about this. It's a national scandal. In Rochdale, minutes were lost of a meeting in which they decided not to investigate after they found hundreds of paedophiles they were investigating in 2005. Nobody knows why they didn't investigate them. Minutes have been lost. Nobody knows. And councillors telling victims and social services telling victims essentially that this is a phase that they'll grow out of, that they're choosing to do this, that their stories are lies, they can't possibly have been beaten, and even if they did have signs of abuse, then you probably were asking for it. And if they didn't have signs of abuse, didn't have any bruises, why aren't you hurt? This can't possibly be abuse. And so there are these consistent themes that happen even in the borderlands of England and Wales, even down in Bristol, up in Glasgow. There are consistent themes here which we're finding without. And so that there's only been a couple of investigations and thousands of victims still waiting for justice is, I think, the biggest scandal of the Elizabethan era. And hopefully, when this film comes out next month, there will be a bit more of an agitation towards fixing it.
Well, we look forward is probably the wrong word.
No, please. I know we
anticipate that documentary eagerly. And do you know when it's coming out? Have you got a release date yet?
The first half of January. I mean, it's not exactly a Christmas film, so it's done. We're post-production now, so we don't want to release it soon because I don't think, if Die Hard's a Christmas film, this absolutely isn't a Christmas film. There's going to be a delay to January. And hopefully when Parliament's back, a lot of people in power might see it and be finally moved to do something useful with their time in this space.
We can only hope. Less about being abused on Twitter, please, yes. Politicians. More about the issues that matter.
Precisely.
We should reach into the postbag, Chris.
Yes.
And then play the theme tune that Chris has produced. Have you heard this theme tune?
Look, what's the jingle? Come on.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Wow.
So, first question here is from Misha Moselle, friend of Spite. What accounts for the UK elite's complete inability to get a grip on any of the problems facing society?
That's a good question. I wondered at myself sometimes. I think a lot about that. You know that clip that surfaced this year of Nick Clegg in 2010 saying there's no point building nuclear power station because it won't be online until 2021? I think about that very regularly. It sums everything up, doesn't it? I suppose one argument would be that these people are not in power for long enough. Now, I mean, Nick Clegg, I guess, wasn't in power for all that long, wasn't even MP for that long. And so they're very short-termist, maybe. One argument would be that, there's been a particularly high amount of turnover in the last few years. I don't buy that really. And even if that were true of ministers, it shouldn't be true of the civil service. I'm more worried about the civil servants. And I wonder how much their brains have been rotted by various stupid ideas over the years. But you normally rely on the civil servants to have this kind of long-term strategic thinking. And that certainly hasn't been the case with energy and quite a few other things. And so no one believes, Sunak, when he gets up to the dispatch box, and I'm going to clamp down on the unions. I'm going to stop these boat crossings. I'm going to clamp down. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. I'm going to clamp down Just Stop All. And 2 weeks later, the police are still making them cups of tea in the road. Yeah, and people don't believe him because Suella Braverman said the same thing before, and Priti Patel said the same thing before that, and Boris Johnson, they all say the same thing. And it's been 12 years of Tory government now, and it's pretty obvious that they can't do anything. And I'm not particularly convinced Labour would do anything either, but, I guess, give them a chance, I suppose. But certainly the Tories have been completely inept in this. Even this coal mine, right, that's been opened.
Bit of good news.
A bit of good news. It almost certainly be turned over in judicial review, I reckon, because it probably goes against whatever stupid laws the MPs have already made in terms of net zero. And then Sunak and people will come out and say this is activist lawyers and judicial activism, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's not really. They're just enforcing the law that you wrote and you went along with because it made you feel like a big man for a day, mm-hmm. you know? And this is a problem. You know, if you don't like the laws that you've made, change the laws. Don't blame lawyers for it. They can't get anything. It's the same with the boat crossings. You know, we probably do need to change laws on refugees. Around the world, we'll probably have to change laws on asylum seekers because they're not really fit for the modern age, right? But they're not going to do that. They're just going to, every few weeks, go, I'm going to definitely do something about this time. You can promise me I'm going to keep illegal immigration down to the tens of thousands next year. You know, I don't know exactly why they're so useless, but they are just useless. Maybe they don't take the job seriously. We've had a lot of people who seem to be political pygmies over the years who just want to be prime minister or just want to be a minister. They don't have any real vision. They get scared by the blob. They get scared off by, again, this coal mine thing. I was quite surprised Gove even did it. So the guy banned house coal only a couple of years ago, and I have to use this bloody smokeless stuff in my house. But he's gone along with it, presumably because there is a very solid case for it. And I don't see how it's going to increase emissions at all, given it's just replacing coal that we were bringing in from Russia or America.
It's okay if we import
but
it.
But you look at the reaction to it. People screaming blue murder about this. And it was the same with fracking. You know, if we can't even
also, it's to
use
make
our own
steel,
shale,
isn't it?
It's to make steel, which will make wind turbines, you know. Fracking in the middle of...
Do they think we're going to make these wind turbines out of, like, recycled glass bottles?
It's going to start burning coal for no reason. It's going to start burning coal for fun now that we've got some, you know. And then they go, oh, well, we're going to export 80% of it. Oh, so what? Well, we won't burn it then, will we? Somebody else, that can be somebody else's carbon budget. I mean, make your mind up about what your objection to this is. Either is that we're going to burn it or we're going to export it. It can't be both, you know? And it was the same with fracking and the same stupid arguments, actually, on fracking, saying, oh, well, nobody wants to do any fracking in this country. It's completely unviable. Mm. Well, why are you so bothered about it being banned? Why does it matter? You must know. You must know that someone wants to frack. Otherwise, you wouldn't care whether it was legal or not, would you? And then it was like, well, it's going to lead to more carbon emissions. Well, how can it if no one's going to frack it? You know what I mean? At least try and be consistent with your bullshit on this particular issue. So you get to, you know, gas prices seven times what they had been 2 years previously, a major international crisis and gas shortage for obvious reasons, and we can't even... drill our own shale gas, frack our own shale gas. That's, to me, it's as bad as the Nick Clegg thing, but it's all part of the same thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If, like, manana, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we could have some economic growth. It would be nice if we could be self-sufficient in energy and things. But actually, I'm more concerned with the climate budget, and net zero and all this kind of stuff. And the thing is, politicians can, just my final point, the politicians, they can do things when they want to. Mm. People go, well, Boris Johnson, the last 3 years have been messed up by COVID. And yeah, fair enough. That obviously has taken a lot of the bandwidth in government. But they still managed to put through this, that thing I mentioned before, end of aisle shopping promotions. They found the time to ban crisps at the end of aisles. They found time to, hold the COP26 conference and strut around saying about all the wonderful things they're going to do. They've found time for the online safety bill. It's only, the trivial stuff, like how to keep the bloody lights on, that they seem to
build enough houses.
Build enough houses.
Things that everyone agrees are quite important. It's quite important to keep the lights on. It's quite important to have affordable housing. But Charlie, what do you make?
Well, there's so much to react there from Snowden's
soliloquy of rage.
Snowden's last stand delivered to an audience of three, Tom, Charlie and producer Rob. Just, it's wasted. Chris, it's wasted on us.
We are recording this.
Yeah. The bit I want to take out would be, you mentioned about how people scream bloody murder and they freak out and they lose the plot. And this has been the success of the screaming bloody murder. Tories freak out, policy dies, something pathetic and weak is replaced immediately. Strategy has been so successful because it just keeps working, right? And so and this is powered by the incentives of Twitter, of course, where people will say increasingly insane things to get their way. I'm going to read a tweet for you today about this coal mine, right? This guy's called James Murray. He edits Business Green, one of the leading news sites, it's called. The approval of the Cumbrian coal mine is one of the worst climate and infrastructure policy decisions, not just in the UK, but globally and historically. Full stop. And that's not entirely hyperbolic. Well, my suggestion, James, is that it might actually be extremely hyperbolic. And you're doing that because you know it will get enormous reaction from your same kind of fettered corner of supporters who have had enormous success from being like, this is evil. This is literally going to destroy the world if we do this. Have a bit of coal, and therefore it gets cancelled immediately. So yeah, so that's definitely a major part of it. And then, as you mentioned, there's also a complete failure to strategize. The short-termism thing, yeah, they are incentivized to think in five-year cycles just on the nature of the job and the structure of our political system, sure. But the more pressing concern, I think, is that despite having all the power in the world, there seems to be, I think, a misunderstanding of how the system works. If you don't like the law, you can actually change it. You are a lawmaker. Many of them don't seem to be aware of this. And they go through their days being like, ah, well, you know, not only is this immoral, it's also unlawful, and therefore I can't possibly, you know, touch this this lever, which will fix all my problems very quickly. I think, you know, to be brutal, I think a lot of them just aren't particularly intelligent, and so capturing legal strategy and the decades old crises that we've endured doesn't actually make much sense to them. So they can't really get a handle on these problems. And the biggest one, you mentioned it briefly, I mean, we could go on about coal all day, but immigration is without a doubt the clearest example of this. There are ways to close these loopholes, to change the laws. Maybe don't do as we're doing now, freeing through the 98% of claims of asylum from Afghanistan that's announced in the last week. No other country does this. No other country has this incredibly stupid approach. The second country closest to this is Sweden, probably my place of birth.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, it's just some deep Charlie Peters facts for you there.
Real fans.
Yeah, for the stalkers. I'll drop my blood group next time. But yeah, place of birth is for now. Mm-hmm. So even Sweden's realizing that it's kind of open doors approach to parts of the world where grenade attacks are a common thing isn't necessarily particularly good for Stockholm and Malmö. But we, for better or worse, I think significantly worse, have yet to come to the same conclusion and change the law.
So let's do one final question. This one's from Michael. In Gerrard's Cross. Hello, Michael. There is some commentary this week reminding us of the pressure for a lockdown a year ago. Is there any evidence that the COVID authoritarians or various media cheerleaders have acknowledged how wrong they were? Chris?
No, not really.
Has Peston done a mea culpa or something?
Peston will never do a mea culpa, ever. We mention Peston every show, don't we?
He's the most unofficial mascot.
Friend like of the show.
Him and the online safety bill make Peston appear in every single show.
No, he will never apologise. No, but I mean, a lot of these people disappeared. Sage was disbanded quite soon after that farce, and I think deliberately so, because Boris Johnson felt he'd been sold a bit of a pub. I still think Boris Johnson deserves credit for standing up against these people. Many, many people would have capitulated. In fact, Mark Drakeford, I think, didn't he?
Yep.
Pretty much locked down in Wales and probably Scotland as well. And indeed, much of Europe, to be fair. You know, we stood alone. Britain stood alone in that winter of 2021-22. But no, there hasn't been much in the way of self-reflection since by the modelers, but I haven't heard much from the modelers since. I don't think they've been doing any modeling since.
They have disappeared almost without a trace. Yeah.
What I have found quite extraordinary is this, maybe you've spoken about it already on some other spike brand, but the last week or so of the these protests in China, right, have been covered enormously.
Yeah.
Look at all this protesting against COVID rules in China, and they are kind of desperately trying to brand them as broader anti-government protests, but really a lot of it seems to be quite directed at China's COVID policy. Now, it's definitely true that a lot of the big protests I saw against COVID in London and in other major cities during our own kind of era of discontent were pretty mental, right? There was some pretty strange...
There was a certain whiff to them, yeah.
There was an aura.
I remember a giant flag with a COVID cell and a swastika.
Yeah, well, you
they
know.
Were literally organised by David Icke.
Oh, yeah, well, there we go. You win some, you lose some.
He was a top speaker.
We shouldn't smear all the attendees, no, but there was a strong contingent, shall we say.
But even still, whenever these protests took place, the national media generally just completely ignored them. And if they did...
Which is a weird thing to do.
Very strange thing to do. And if they
regardless of what you think of them.
And if they did focus on them, they would do what we just did, which is talk about David, you know, and the various freak shows involved. They would completely lampoon the entire kind of anti-lockdown crowd, or people who are susceptible to... people who are kind of not so sure about the lockdown business. They would put them all together in this one bracket of nutterdom. But now, when it comes to China, there is this feeling now, I think there's such a vibe shift away from product and experiences that they think, oh, well, actually being protesting against lockdown is a really good thing now. And
but even your man in Canada was doing that, wasn't he? Trudeau.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable. This guy got a solidarity with the protesters in China. Because, I mean, he was
jailing
unbelievably authoritarian with the Canadian truckers now, wasn't he?
Well, people flying into Canada were subject to, like, extraordinary kind of, like, it'd make Guantanamo Bay look like quite a cozy retreat. Yeah. Can't hear the swabbing, not the swabbing.
Well, on that nice bit of nostalgia, Charlie, Chris, thank you very much.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.